RN is also a great read. Find feature articles online at our homepage.
And hello, welcome to Life Matters on RN. Natasha Mitchell joining you. Great to have your company this morning. Tell me, what were you wearing 5 years ago? What were you wearing 20 years ago? What about 60 years ago? Are you prepared to admit the history of fashion in our lives is about so much more, isn't it, than the threads we wear? There's a story of social change, of political change, of emancipation. And the opposite too. Two heavyweights of the Australian fashion world join us today. Together, Deborah Thomas, former editor of The Weekly, and Kirsty Clements, former editor of Vogue Australia, have pulled strings in the fashion world for many years. And we're also going to meet a couple who have been pulling strings of a different kind for a living, for all their working lives too. Puppets are their profession. I'm really looking forward to meeting this husband and wife team. We're on Twitter at RN Life Matters. Talk to us. When did you move out of home? You may well still be living at home in your 20s now, and that's not so unusual, is it, amongst many of your peers these days? Or if you have moved out of home, are you still getting a fair bit of help with rent, with tuition fees, or perhaps a warm meal, a load of washing here and there? That's not the case for thousands of 18-year-olds across Australia right now, because if you happen to be in state care in your teens, so foster care or group homes, your accommodation officially ends when you hit 18, at which point it's up to you to make your own way in the world. And that's daunting at the best of times, isn't it? But after a childhood in state care, you're facing a whole lot of other difficulties too. And so the Council of Homeless Persons, the peak body for homelessness in Victoria, really wants this issue addressed, and they've outlined in a proposal in a pre-budget submission to their state government or what they think should happen for these 18-year-olds. Joining me now is in fact 18-year-old Jamie. She knows what it's like to move in and out of state care, and her living situation now is rather precarious by the sounds. Welcome, Jamie.
Hello, thank you.
Good to have you here. Sari Toohey is with us too. She's the policy manager for the Council of Homeless Persons.
Hi, Natasha.
Thanks, Sarah. And also on her way will be Deb Ireland. She works for Anglicare Victoria, and they run now a specialised program called Breaking the Barriers. Sarah, I'll start with you. We know that there are around 26,000 young people who don't have a safe, secure place to call home each night across Australia. Do we know what proportion of those have left a state care situation?
What we know, Natasha, is that in Victoria, around 400 young people age out of care every year. And last year, 127 of those came to homelessness services seeking help. So that's a really large amount of those large number of young people who, after moving out of care, find themselves in a situation where they don't have a safe and secure place to live.
Mm. I mean, that term, age out of care, it's brutal, really, isn't it?
Because
need care all our lives. We need care out of our teens and into our 20s and onwards.
I think that's right. And I think if you think about young people, you know, people's children, will, even if they're not living with them, you know, in their early 20s, they'll still be able to call, borrow $20 here and there, ask stupid questions that you do when you first move out of home and you don't sort of know what setting to put the oven on and things like that. But lots of young people leaving care don't have that kind of support they can call on.
Well, they don't have a lot more than that too, and some data that I saw out of Monash University suggests that half of all young people who leave state care will end up homeless in the first 12 months. Is that a true statistic? That is brutal if it's true.
Look, it's an enormous statistic, and I think more troubling, and the reason there's a lots of reasons why we're particularly concerned about this, but when you look at people who've experienced long-term homelessness, so chronic homelessness throughout their life, almost half of those will have also experienced state care as a young person. So we really need to get the care experience and the leaving care experience right, not only to prevent homelessness in the short term, but in the long term over someone's life as well.
Certainly, I can't imagine all foster parents, when a foster child turns 18, those foster parents going, right, you're out.
No, that's not what happens. And a lot of foster parents will just allow people to continue living with them for a period of time. There's also some incentives in the state government where you can foster carers can still receive payments after someone's 18, particularly if they're still in school. But not all young people in care are in foster care. So a lot of young people are in residential care, and a lot of young people are in kinship care. Now, kinship care is where you're with another family member, and that's often a really good and supportive way to be able to live without your parents. But residential care is really tricky. It's not the same home-like environment, try as workers might to create that environment for people. It is a very different thing.
I mean, thinking about payments, I'm also thinking of the youth allowance for over 18-year-olds. And if you are turfed out of a residential care situation, I mean, $200 a fortnight, just over $200 a fortnight, is not going to take you very far in the rental market.
Absolutely. It's not going to take you anywhere in the rental market. We, our leaving care guarantee that we're calling on the state government to fund, we did some calculations around what the gap between an affordable rent is and youth allowance. And we didn't look at the inner suburbs because, frankly, the gap is ridiculously large and no one can fund that gap. But we looked at middle and outer ring suburbs in Melbourne, and even in share houses in a middle to outer ring suburb, there's a $40 a week gap between what's affordable for a young person on Newstart and what the median rent actually is.
Jamie, let me come to you. Tell us about your housing situation right now. Things sound pretty touch and go.
Things are very touch and go for me at the moment. I've been living in and out of a refuge for the past month and a half. It's been hard because I was in residential care and then I went into Lee Tenant. And after you turn 18, you don't really get that support unless you have the support workers.
Mm. What was the residential care like for you?
It was good. I lived with a few unsavoury people. But besides that, the staff members were really nice and they tried as hard as they could to make it like a home-based care, but it was never really the same.
So when you look at what's happened for you recently, why has it been so difficult? What's made it really difficult for you to have stable housing?
I think it's just, I'm not actually 100% sure, to be honest. It's more rent-wise, trying to find myself a house that I can actually afford. It's pretty difficult with how little money I get, but I've got my support worker from Breaking Barriers, Anglicare, who's actually been very helpful. She's been helping me find properties that are around the price range that I can afford, and she's been helping me by taking me to a few of the appointments that I've needed to go to and stuff like that.
That real support. You, I think, were removed from your family 10 or more years ago now.
Yes, that is correct. I was removed at the age of 6.
At 6. So how, in that time, have you been moving from house to house? Have you been living in foster care situations?
Yes, I never stayed anywhere longer than 2 years. Mm. I lived in foster care, residential units, Lee Tenant. It's been very difficult to move around as much as I have.
I can imagine. What did that mean for school and all the other aspects of your life?
Well, I moved schools a lot. I don't even know how many schools I've been to now. I've lost count. And I've always constantly had to keep making new friends, which is also very difficult for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd hope that you could get to stay in one foster home. Why did you need to move on?
A lot of the time it was because the foster carers had to move or because the placement just broke down. I was, let's say, a very difficult child to look after.
Well, probably because of the circumstances you were in.
Yeah, I believe so.
Has there been anyone along the way, other than Anglicare now, and we'll get to that with Deb, but has there been anyone, Jamie, that you've been able to turn to at different times for help?
Yeah, I've had different agencies like Westcare, Anglicare in Broadmeadows, MacKillop and my springboard worker. They've always been very helpful for me as well.
But at the moment it's couch surfing for you predominantly.
Yes, at the moment it is.
So how did you end up making contact with the Breaking the Barriers program?
Well, when I left Westcare, as I left my lead tenant, they referred me to Breaking Barriers Anglicare, and I met Brooke through them, and Brooke's been my worker ever since I left, which is actually, it's been a major help for me.
Well, let's hear how Breaking the Barriers works. Deb Ireland, Yep. You made it.
I did, finally.
through that Melbourne traffic. You work for Anglicare Victoria. You set up the Breaking the Barriers program in 2011. So, I mean, I imagine that Jamie's experience is intensely familiar to you.
It is. It's very, very common for the leaving care group of people.
So I get the sense there are a few different difficulties here. There's the unstable living situation a young person has in their teens if they're in a foster care or state care situation, and then there's also that transition when they hit 18. These must be tightly linked.
They are. I think the thing with the transition at 18 is it's very sudden, and although there is a lot of preparation to sort of in behind the scenes for these young people, they're not actually experiencing that. So there's a real disconnect all of a sudden from everything they've known. And when you listen to Jamie speaking, she talked about what people are out there supporting her, and you'll note she listed organisations, not people. So I think that's a really big indicator of where we've got a really big issue.
So what prompted you to put together the Breaking the Barriers program? What barriers are you trying to break?
Pretty much all of them. Social connectedness is key. These young people, because of the nature of them being shifted from placement to placement, school to school, organisation to organisation, they don't make any connections. And that's where you learn just about everything, is through your family connections, your peer pressure groups, what's the social norm, what's the right behaviour in different situations. And if you haven't got that, which is really quite fundamental to growing up, then you just don't develop that social ability, I guess, to then function in a very adult and complicated world at 18.
So this is about life skills, sometimes the absolute basics, isn't it?
Yes.
So tell us the approach that you're taking. For someone like Jamie, for example, where do you start?
Relationship is key. So, building the trust between Jamie and whoever is going to be supporting her. Consistency, so being able to have the same person every time Jamie hits a rock, so that she knows when she rings, she's going to get Brooke. And the role modelling that Brooke will give Jamie, hopefully, will stand her in good stead when she finishes with Breaking the Barriers. So it's about being almost like her locus parent, I guess.
Mm. So give us some examples. Can you get us some tangible examples of how you take a young person's hand?
They're small. I think the keys are small things like one example of a client that I worked with was when she was turning 21, which is at the point we close, we took her to high tea. Now, she honestly just had no idea that high tea even existed, and that was her 21st birthday.
That's
present
great.
From us.
As in but scones was, and tea?
Yes, on the three-tier plate and everything. But
oh, I love it.
She was very uncomfortable in that environment.
Well, I'd be uncomfortable in that environment.
She'd not experienced that, another young person asked if they could have for their 21st a night out. And we were able to organise that. So it's about giving them very normal experiences that perhaps your 18 or 21-year-old at home would take for granted.
But, Deb, that's not going to put a roof over someone's head.
No. The way that we need to tackle that is much bigger. It is, as Jamie said, trying to find affordable places to rent, but it's not just finding those places. Normally they have to share, so that then comes back to their social ability to get on with other people. They often don't have a positive peer group, so that can negatively sometimes influence their placement options and break them down. So it does, even though money is very key, it also comes back to their ability to connect back into the community.
Did I hear one of you try to chime in?
That was me, because
Sarah Toohey from the Council of Homeless Persons.
And I should actually handball this over to Jamie, but as we were talking in the studio, she was telling me about how Brooke took her to do her learner's permit test. I mean, that's a really, for me, a really great example of the very basic, very helpful, very practical things that parents would do for you.
Yeah, Jamie, give us a sense of some of those practical things that you've managed to get support to do.
Well, I've had Brooke transporting me to appointments, getting me my appointments. I see her at least every fortnight. She helps me with food vouchers, food hampers, taxi vouchers for when I have to travel home late at night after work. helping me with my learners was a very big one.
That's freedom, isn't it? A car, wheels would be the hope.
They even paid for my year 12 graduation. They paid for my dress, my shoes, getting my hair done, my nails done. They helped me pay for the things that I didn't have the money for, the things that I really wanted to get done.
What difference has that made? I mean, making it, for example, to your school formal in a new dress.
It made a really big difference, to be honest. Like, my year 12 graduation, I was worried I'd have to wear, you know, just any normal dress that I had in my closet. But as soon as I told Brooke that my year 12 graduation was coming up, she was like, well, we need to go shopping then. We need to get you a new dress, shoes, we need to get your hair done. And it honestly, for me, Brooke is just like, you know, an adoptive parent. She's been looking after me since I turned 18. She's been helping me since I turned 18, and without her, I'd be lost.
And yet still, housing is damn hard to come by.
It is, but Brooke's also been looking into houses for me, which has been really good, because I have difficulty focusing when I'm trying to look for houses myself. I get very easily distracted. And so Brooke's been helping me with that. She makes a few phone calls for me when I need them and
get you started. This morning, Jamie is with me, as is Deb Ireland from Anglicare Victoria, who runs the Breaking the Barriers program for young people leaving state care. As we're hearing, it's really hard to find stable housing and just get started after you leave a state care situation like foster care or institutional care. Sarah Toohey is with us too. She's with the Council of Homeless Persons. They're the peak body in Victoria on homelessness. So, Sarah, you have actually put forward, I think, a proposal to the Victorian government of what you would like to see happen for young people in this situation. What's in that proposal?
So what we're proposing is a leaving care housing guarantee. Now, that was a suggestion that came out of some academic work a couple of years ago. And what it means is that a young person, we're proposing a fund that will provide a rental supplement for a young person up to the age of 25 or 7 years after leaving care, because lots of people do leave before the age of 18, and it's those young people who are actually really vulnerable to homelessness.
So what sort of payment are you looking at here?
So we're looking at a basically $80 a week was the average calculation that we made that would bridge the rent gap for people in a shared housing situation. So it's not like we're looking at single bedroom apartments. We're actually looking at what's a normal housing situation for someone sort of 18 to 24, and how can we help make sure that they can afford that throughout their lifetime.
And I think that amounts to annual payments of $4,000 for a young person until they hit 25.
That's right. And so, look, $4,000 a year sounds like quite a lot, but if we can prevent youth homelessness, that's a lifetime saving of $700,000.
And would you see that money being corralled into rent specifically?
Definitely. It's definitely a rent payment that should be attached to the kinds of leaving care support programs that Deb's been talking about, because it's not just about housing costs. It is about learning how to navigate life as a young adult. But navigating life as a young adult, if you don't have any financial support from your parents, is just sort of mathematically impossible.
Yeah. How likely do you think something like that is to get up, given that budget cuts are happening all over the shop?
I think it's really tight. I mean, budgets are always incredibly tight and it's always incredibly hard to make the case for these kinds of things. But I think the compelling evidence around the link between leaving out-of-home care and experiencing homelessness in later life is just so compelling that this investment up front can make not only a real difference in individuals' lives, which personally I think is the most important thing, but it can make a long-term saving to government, and that makes financial sense.
Jamie, I'm interested in, I mean, it's one thing to get a formal dress and be able to go to your school formal. That kind of support is meaningful now. But do you feel like you're developing a different kind of confidence that will allow you, in a sense, to find your own path?
Definitely. While being in DHS care, I was a very shy young person. I had no confidence whatsoever. I used to like to hide away and in my room and just read. I wouldn't go out with friends or anything. But ever since leaving DHS care and getting the support, I've become a lot more confident. Like, I would never have 6 months ago, I would never have dreamed of being on the radio talking to you guys. I would have been way too shy to do it.
Here you are.
Definitely.
And Deb, to you finally, I mean, this is not an issue that's gone away. This has been flagged in numerous reports countless times. What do you see will allow for traction on this issue?
I think we just have to, like Sarah said, we just have to keep making it a public issue. It's not going to go away. Young people are being referred back into the system in their thousands in Victoria alone. So this is not an issue that's going to be quickly solved. I think the plan of subsidising these young people financially will be a very positive step. We've found with breaking the barriers, if we can, I know it sounds terrible, but put money to the problem, we can sometimes avert a lot of disasters.
It counts. Look, thank you all for joining us this morning. Deb Ireland from Anglicare Victoria and the Breaking the Barriers program. Sarah Toohey from the Council for Homeless Persons in Victoria. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
And Jamie, thank you very much. Yes, you were on the radio nationally. Well done. I look forward to seeing what you do next. Thanks for taking the time, folks, and joining us to talk through this one. Appreciate it very much.
No problem.
And perhaps you have an experience of this that you'd like to share. Perhaps you're a foster parent with a point of view on this issue as well, and whether you've had a young person leave your care, what sort of support have you felt you can continue with them? Natasha Mitchell with you on RN, here on Life Matters. 50 years of fashion coming up next.
This Week in This American Life, Andrea's head tingles, and I mean it literally tingles, when she hears the sound of typing, the flipping of pages, or people talking like this.
This is gentle whispering.
Now then, barely touch the canvas.
I'm going to share something personal.
Andrea always thought that she was the only one who felt these tingles. But was she? That's Sunday night, 7 o'clock, here on ABC Radio National.
Look, few magazines have had such an enduring place on shop shelves and in so many women's lives. And if we think back to when this particular magazine began, 1933, George V still reigned, Joseph Lyons was Prime Minister, World War II hadn't started yet, the Great Depression was upon us. It was the first year, apparently, I read somewhere, that traffic lights became operational in Sydney. The first Blinky Bill book was published. How life has changed. The Australian Women's Weekly has been with us ever since then. Its publication was really the first time that Australian women had their own dedicated face in the media in Australia. And a new book, beautifully produced, charts its 50 years through its coverage of fashion trends. And I'm joined in the studio by the book's co-authors, a tour de force collaboration, I might add. Deborah Thomas is former editor-in-chief of The Weekly. Kirsty Clements is former longtime editor-in-chief of Vogue Australia, and you have come together for this project, Deborah.
We have an unlikely collaboration when you think about it, Vogue and the Australian Women's Weekly, but we're friends, and with my experience at the Australian Women's Weekly, I felt that I was very well-versed in terms of the history of the weekly, but I really wanted to have somebody who knew fashion better than I did, and there's no better person than Kirsty and her knowledge of fashion, so we thought that would be a fun project to work together.
So you've contemplated, Kirsty, the 50 years of Vogue, the first 50 years of Vogue Australia, haven't you?
Yes, I did. There was a book in Vogue, 50 Years of Australian Style, which I co-authored with Lee Tulloch in 2009. So it was, and of course I was with Vogue for so many years, for 25 years. So it was wonderful to work on the weekly. And I wasn't privy to all of those images before from those early decades, only probably since when my mother bought it. And it was just fascinating for me to look at it and see what a beautiful magazine it was.
Differences between Vogue and the weekly, do you think, in those early years?
Well, Vogue didn't start till 59 and the weekly started in 33. And of course the first few decades of the weekly are illustrated. And they are so beautiful. I mean, Australia never had a more beautiful magazine than the Women's Weekly. And of course, they're different because the Weekly, while it was, I was surprised how fashionable it was actually, because it was very influenced by the trends from the catwalks and from Paris, but making them relevant to Australian women, there was an extra set of relevance that I think potentially Vogue didn't have that the Weekly did, which made it just fascinating to work on as a cultural exploration.
Yeah, made it distinct, didn't it? Take us back to 1933. Frank Packer was at the helm. And I just love the front page of the first edition, which is Equal Social Rights for Sexes. Mrs. Linda P. Littlejohn outlines the big issues to be fought for. This is 1933.
And as you say, it was started by Sir Frank Packer. And the first editor of the Australian Women's Weekly was a man called George Wanecki. And what they wanted to do was to create a whole magazine for women. There'd always been women's sections in the newspapers, but nothing that really kind of encompassed all aspects of a woman's life. So that was the idea around this. And they wanted to do it with a news angle. So everything had to have a news angle, whether it be about baby, whether it be about family, whether it be about food, fashion, and in fact what was happening in not society as society, the elite, but just in general across the news. So the Weekly had to bring all of that together from a female perspective. And I think that it was interesting that the first issue, as you're talking about there, was in the same format as we know the Daily Telegraph today. So it was a black and white tabloid newspaper format. And you've mentioned that equal social rights. But I think what was also interesting is what smart Sydney women are wearing. Camera pictures, because most fashion was illustrated. So the Weekly was way ahead of its time by having photographs of the fashion. But of course, it was what the social set were wearing, because fashion was so elite back in those days. And unless you were very wealthy, you really couldn't indulge in that sort of area.
That's interesting, and we'll get to that. This was, I think, it was at twopence.
Tuppence.
I'm a girl of that currency, so tuppence. I'm so not, am I? That was a big sacrifice. This was the Depression era, and yet women came to it, those early editions, in their droves, it seems to me.
Well, it sold out in a day, I believe, and the whole premise behind this was to make it affordable, keep it as a low price so that women could buy it, you know, well aware that the Depression was happening. So they saw it, I think, as escapism, as information, and one of the things that we know is that when people are financially challenged, they do tend to look for entertainment and sort of, I guess that was the whole premise behind it, was to keep it affordable. And it hit the stands in 1933 in May, first of all only New South Wales, and then became national around September. But it was sold out first and foremost, I think, because it had that really Australian flavour, that very local way of talking to people from a very Australian perspective.
Mm, but despite Mrs. Littlejohn's foray into social rights, you do acknowledge, Deborah, the conservatism of the Women's Weekly.
Yes, the Women's Weekly was always meant to be fairly apolitical. And the fact is, it reflected the times. It didn't set the agenda for women. It reflected what was happening. Now, a lot of that also had to do with the editor. So whoever was the editor, if you had an editor who was sort of more of a feminist, you're going to get that kind of angle than perhaps the more conservative editors. But once you get to the 60s and also the 70s, you know, it was impossible to ignore the pill, the fact that, we're, you know, women's liberation, all these sorts of things. But if we go back a little bit to the 1940s, I think it's really interesting, because when war broke out, women's roles really changed. And the Australian Women's Weekly really reflected. You're seeing pictures of women in dungarees and taking on the jobs that were traditionally male when the men had gone off to fight the war. They also had the first ever female war correspondent who went over and reported back from not quite the front line, but sort of thereabouts. So it was really interesting the way that the magazine brought back, again, from a women's perspective, what was happening to our troops abroad.
This book is very much about documenting all this through the fashion as it was represented. Kirsty, 1933 was a two-piece swimsuit landed in the magazine. That was a first, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's photographed from the back, I think, and it's a wonderful collage where the fabric's been cut out and pasted down. But that is a first. They were almost like play suits. You know, they're not bikinis as such. They're play suits.
The latest daring surf suits from overseas way they were described.
But again, reflecting the local culture that, you know, you will see through it, particularly in the 50s, a lot of bikini shots, and 40s too, Betty Grable and those wonderful one-piece swimsuits. So it did reflect that Australian way of life as well as reflecting what was happening globally. But, I mean, for me, the 30s was an incredible period for the Weekly in terms of how they were pushing the boundaries artistically and the beautiful illustrations, the beautiful prints. And
every week. That's every what kills week. Me. They were pulling that, creating that imagery every week. Lush colour, detail.
Yeah, print, and the beauty of the beauty pages and the makeup and the hairstyles. It's incredibly sophisticated, incredibly sophisticated.
Thinking about the 30s, though, because that was the decade in this book that most interested me as well. But because of all the different tensions being played out, you'd emerge from the flamboyance of the 1920s. And women's, the ready wear was beginning, wasn't it, for women? And the suits. And then on to, into the pants. You know, this was a major shift for women in terms of fashion.
Yes, I was surprised. There's an image there. It's probably my favourite image from the book. Is it's the late 30s, and I think Coco Chanel, of course, is starting to emerge in Paris. And the model has on a halter neck top and high-waisted pants, wide, probably linen pants, and one of a sort of a coolie hat. And that is such an incredible, I mean, I'd wear that now. Mm. And it is so significant for that period. But the 30s are quite liberating in terms of dress. When you look at it, the corsets had gone. The clothes were not as short as even flapper clothes. They were a little bit more discreet in terms of their length.
Despite it being the Depression, they were quite emphatic about that, weren't they? They were going to keep the length.
They kept the fabric. They
despite
did keep the
sacrifice.
Yeah, they had to sacrifice the fabric later on during wartime, but they did keep it in the 30s, and it's a very elegant period. And of course, there were a lot of cloaks as well. I mean, imagine evening cloaks, how beautiful, that were very influenced by Joan Crawford and what was coming out of Hollywood at the time. And in the late 30s, with Gone with the Wind, the Scarlett O'Hara, the big puffy, probably not my favourite, but great for a photo, the big puffy sleeves and the big picture hats and skirts, that came in as well. Mm. So, no, there was quite a lot of fabric right up until wartime shortage.
What happened in wartime?
Well, there were actually edicts that you were not supposed to use. In Paris, there were edicts that you couldn't use more than a certain amount, metres of fabric, and also with shoes, that you had to find materials that were, you know, more frugal. The frugality came in fact. And even with the prints changed so that they didn't want to waste too much fabric trying to match prints, so that the prints got smaller, so that it wasn't, you didn't have to have that finesse, which is quite incredible.
Real conscious effort.
And, of course, hats, because the Weekly would show, I don't think that there was a week the Weekly didn't show hats, but they would show how to do your own at home with fabrics. So tulle, you could inexpensively get tulle and wrap it around your head and fashion a hat. So I love the way the Weekly took super high fashion but made it relatable and made it, you know, economical.
It still took its cue from the international catwalks, though, didn't it? That was its primary focus, or did it actually focus on innovators and the creatives in Australia?
Not in the 1940s. It was very much overseas fashion. And the fashion editor was, in fact, the sister, was Mary Horden, who was the sister of Gretel Packer, Sir Frank's first wife. So she knew all about what was going on overseas in terms of fashion. So during the war, as Kirsty said, it was about sort of making everyday objects into sort of fashion. You know, there's one hat that's pictured in the book where you've got a doily and old sort of bonds tickets or those sorts of things.
It's like the craft fashion movement
exactly,
of today.
Exactly. But after the war, with Mary Horden as the fashion editor, it got very, very chic, where she was obviously travelling to Paris. So she was the first to bring the Dior new look, which was the little cinched waist, those beautiful jackets, to Australia. And she collaborated then with David Jones. And it was the first time, I think, that French fashions had arrived in Australia, or Parisian fashions had arrived in Australia, where most people could see them. It wasn't something that was just someone bringing back their own frock. But women at that time, we didn't really have a fashion industry as such. It was very much about the dressmaker. If you're very wealthy, you went off to Paris and you had your clothes made for you, or London. If you weren't so wealthy, you would look and see what the Women's Weekly was showing, and then you'd whip it up on your sewing machine at home.
With me in the studio on Life Matters this morning is Deborah Thomas, former editor-in-chief of The Weekly, and Kirsty Clements, fashion editor and former editor-in-chief of Vogue Australia. They have come together in a collaboration for a beautifully illustrated book, because this was a magazine that was beautifully illustrated. It's called Fashion, the Australian Women's Weekly, Fashion, the First 50 Years. I did find that transition from the 40s, where women were in their pants and their dungarees and there was, you know, fashion was frugal, women were out there in force doing stuff, and then we were back in our corsets in the 1950s.
It was about to give the men back their jobs, get back into the house. The 1950s were a boom time for Australia. So there was financially, it was, people were much better off. So the idea of the big skirts and, you know, the family and so on came to the fore straight
and
after that.
Little
and,
tiny waist.
And I was just looking through the book a little bit earlier. There's a lovely cover of June Dely Watkins in an apron as well, which kind of says it all in the 1950s. And it was about cake baking, looking after the family, looking after your husband. So it must have been quite difficult for a lot of women who really loved the liberation of the 1940s and the fact that they could get out there and get a job. And then it was, you know, sorry ladies, back to where you were how many ever years ago. And then of course the 60s straight after that turned that around.
Sure did. But the Weekly really did go right back in the home.
Yes.
Back in your corsets. How do you view the corset? Because it's had a sort of revival, a kind of neo-goth revival.
Well, I mean, it's depending on whether it's a choice or a fashion, really, isn't it? I mean, I think with the 50s, those tiny waists, it's beautiful to look at. Everybody that picks up those photos, most women go, oh, look at it. But to actually wear it was quite difficult. Nobody always had that figure type. Not everybody had that figure type.
Have you tried getting in a corset?
A corset? I do have a Dolce & Gabbana one, but I think I bought that in a moment of jet lag. Because
maybe that's like 14 now as opposed to a 14-inch waist.
I'm not sure that anybody really wants to see me in that corset. But there were options in the 50s that if you didn't have a waist, I'm sure many people, and I think that there was a particular more mature woman who didn't want to. You had that long, sleek pencil skirt with the hip-length jacket, that real Eve Arden look, if you think about it, you know. But the end of the 50s, because they started to recognise teenagers as a force for fashion, you saw the introduction of the capri pant. I love that. I completely love that period of the capri pant and the ballet flat. And the sweater that starts to move into the 60s as well. So, you know, the 50s, while it started out very constricted, it's great to watch that decade and see it get to loosen up and get into that youthquake idea of the 60s.
Yeah, and then the 60s.
I was going to say also the royals played a big part. We had a young Queen Elizabeth crowned and her very, very glamorous sister, Princess Margaret, who was at the time considered to be the sort of absolute fashion icon. So all eyes were on Margaret. The Queen had to be a little bit more conservative, but Margaret could do whatever she wanted. She could wear the Paris fashions and so on. I think a lot of Australian women look to those sisters
to take their
fashion
cues.
Probably, although Elizabeth was very glamorous when she was young. She certainly wore...
She's quite with a full skirt because she had a tiny waist. Do you remember she wore that felt skirt to an event once?
And the gloves and the hats. And you know, Queen Elizabeth was probably on the cover of the Australian Women's Weekly more than anybody else, I think, has graced it. So a lot of people looking to that very sort of glamorous royal way of dressing, which was very formal. They were very formal in the 1950s. Women were very formal. It was hats and gloves. If you went to the city, you took your hat and your gloves. You didn't go to the city without really dressing up.
Yes, I'm thinking of my grandmother and how she coped within the subsequent generations. At the end of this 50-year history that you've documented, though, do you think there's anything in the market today, or will there be anything in the market today that in the future that breaks that breaks new ground as the Weekly might have?
I think the Weekly had that space to themselves for quite a while because we didn't have the proliferation of media that we have today. These days we've got information coming from so many sources. You know, it's real time. It's doing it in real time. If you think about the Australian Women's Weekly and you look at the covers, and many of the covers would feature news items, whether it be the building of the Sydney Opera House or it's the photographs of the men who are about to make their way to the moon, royal weddings and so on. We didn't have coloured photographs. We didn't have coloured television then. Mm-hmm. So often those covers of the Australian Women's Weekly, which would take a week to arrive, was the only way that Australians saw some things of those news items in colour. Now there's just so many ways. And I suppose if you want to look at it, you know, if you could have held it back when it first started, probably the internet you'd say. But, you know, it's just that the Women's Weekly was a unique proposition at a time where women didn't have access to a lot of that sort of material. They needed to get that every week. They waited for that magazine to come to tell them news of abroad and what was happening locally, what to cook, what to knit, how to dress.
Mm. Very powerful publication.
Very powerful publication. But as I say, it stood as a beacon that was separate to probably whatever else was on offer, and there wasn't a lot.
Thank you so much to you both for joining us on Life Matters today.
Pleasure.
Very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on the publication.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Deborah Thomas, former editor-in-chief of The Weekly, and Kirsty Clements, former editor-in-chief of Vogue Australia. My guests this morning on Life Matters. The book is called The Australian Women's Weekly, The First 50 Years of Fashion, published by the National Library of Australia, actually, because this is part of a whole effort to digitise the archive of the magazine. So it's all available for you to check out. Just head to the Trove website, which is an absolute boon. In fact, put your family details in. You may find some interesting archival material on Trove about your own family. We'll link to it from the Life Matters webpage. We've got some extra special guests that have just flooded into the studio. All will become clear.
It began in 1976 when a boy from Sydney jumped out of his bedroom window to see a band. For punk archivist John Billington, it's led to a lifelong passion. He wears a grey suit
on his body and his mind. That's Recollections, a show for crate diggers, vinyl lovers and Australian music fans. Sunday night, 9:30 on RN.
Oh yes, I'll be tuning into that for sure. And I wonder if you saw yesterday the announcement of a new radio station called Double J, which is really going to tap into some of the same genre as well. So those classic rubbery figures, remember them? I used to love them as a kid. It really was political satire at its best. What's the difference between a puppeteer and a politician? Not quite as much as you might think, according to one of my next guests. John Lewis has been pulling puppet strings since he was five. He and his wife Jackie and their son Nicholas now are the hands and the brains behind Jarrell Puppets. Jarrell Puppets, Australia's oldest puppet company, apparently. It's quite a gig, and they are both in the studio, and there's a whole stack of guests that they've brought in who will remain. Oh, look, I think that's Pinocchio. Oh, no, how cute.
This is a Pinocchio string puppet. If everyone looks very closely at their radio dial, they'll see he's carved out of wood.
You and carved him?
Yes, I carved him. Most of our puppets are made out of fabric. And Jackie and I do the sewing. I do the designing and make the patterns, and then we do the sewing together. So we've got a whole lot of puppets for people to see on the radio.
And I've got my hand up one now too.
Yes.
This is so brilliant.
That's, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands.
Which, because if I pull it, that's actually a caterpillar.
He's a caterpillar.
And if I pull that string,
and sing.
Now, if I sing, if I open his mouth, can you do the singing?
I'm not very good at singing. Okay. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands.
Clap.
Oh, quick, I've got to do that move.
Yes.
No, you just failed your audition. Sorry.
Oh, how beautiful. Look, lovely to have you both here. What's this about puppets and politicians, John?
Well, I always get offended when they talk about politicians as being puppeteers, because I think it's a very bad put down on puppeteers, although there have been a number of puppeteers who've been politicians. I actually stood for local council about 15 or 16 years ago.
Because they get to pull the strings.
Well, yeah, and there was a politician in Connecticut who actually used to do the string puppets on Howdy Doody, a very famous American puppet show, and he was actually a congressman.
Well, there you go.
So there is a crossover, but in actual fact, we feel that having politicians sort of pretending to be puppeteers is not very good for the reputation of puppeteers. We like to feel we're sort of clean. But puppeteers have always been using political satire. I've made about 1,600 puppets since I was five, so that's like 58 years of making puppets. I suppose our most notorious puppet was a political puppet of Gough Whitlam, which we were due to do on the Mike Walsh show on the 11th of November in 1975.
And?
Which was the day that Whitlam got
sacked.
Oh, no. Actually, it was the day
you
before
had a puppet
we were due
ready to
do
go.
It. We got cancelled. Oh. We got cancelled, so that puppet just didn't ever get there.
Now, your second generation, your son is now, well, third generation or
well,
even fourth.
Well, actually...
So, he's doing a show at the very moment we speak. He said to tell you that he's an expert manipulator, unless we're talking about our pussycat.
Who manipulates the entire household.
See, for John, this started way back for you. You started putting on shows and even professional shows at a very young age.
Well, my family was totally fed up with puppets before I was born because... My father's aunt and uncle, Kay and Alan Lewis, were Australia's first professional puppeteers. And in 1937, they set out on a huge project to make a wonderful marionette show, which was going to make them a fortune. Never made them the fortune, but it made an absolutely wonderful show. But in those years, nobody knew what a puppet was, so they were up against it. And at one stage, they had a young assistant called Peter Finch, who... didn't stick around in puppetry very long, but went on to do other things like winning an Academy Award. And
but for you, it started very young. You started putting on shows when you were five.
I think I saw my first puppet show when I was about four. And by the time I was five, we happened to live near the one and only puppet theatre in Australia at that stage in Clovelly, the Clovelly Puppet Theatre. And they taught children how to make puppets on Friday afternoons. And I went along with my brother and we started making puppets. So at the end of the year when I was five, I did my first puppet show in front of an audience. And I think at that stage I decided that that's what I wanted to do with my life. And so I spent all my time that I was in school making puppets, and I started doing puppets professionally for Grace Brothers department stores just as I was turning 16.
I think they got you to run the Christmas pantomime.
Yeah, well, my very first gig with them was producing 3.5 weeks of string puppet shows, but it used to take about 2 hours to get ready for a 20-minute show, so we decided string puppets just had too much gear and we went to puppets worked on our hands. And so then all through my university career, I spent most of that in television studios, which was an embarrassment to the architecture faculty at New South Wales, because in the middle of all of that, they had to give me the prize as best student in the faculty.
Oh. I think you managed to make an awful lot of architecture projects at university puppet-based.
Well, the only way they could get me interested was by letting me do things. So I spent a year stress-testing wooden panels and things to come up with the ultimate puppet stage, but it managed to keep them happy. Jackie, on the other hand, was trained as a special ed teacher.
Yes, yeah. Let's get to Jackie. Oh, Jackie, look, so I you started in teaching. Well, you fell into it because
we met at university and we fell madly in love. And I was first year university, I was just 18 and John was 19. He was boy wonder. He was already producing children's television and in the news and in the Sydney Morning Herald and... working all the time and was very good looking, so that did help. he was quite interesting. So,
you were clear you were going to be a teacher. Well, that was what you were doing.
I always wanted to be a writer, since John was on television, he used to get me to write little skits, because he was running out of material. So I would go to lectures and sometimes write little skits for him, and he would use them on television, and his ratings were really good, so this encouraged me enormously. So yes, I did finish teaching, but we were already working. We got married while still at university, and then we were thrown into Channel 9 on a daily basis, just different channel.
Before,
To do puppets.
What sort of puppetry were you doing with Channel 9?
We were on something called the Super Flying Fun Show. John had previously been on Channel 7 on an incredibly rating program that he was producing and directing and taking care of. And then we moved to Channel 9. They offered us the last half hour of the Super Flying Fun Show because they were extending the program. They said, we'd like you to do it with puppets.
And what were the characters that you brought onto the show?
That was very interesting. We, in order to fit into the format, we had to come up with almost serial-type sketches. So we had two logo characters that we made, called Murgatroyd and his dog Fleabag.
They're still actually around. Mm. So Murgatroyd recently celebrated his 42nd birthday. He was actually made on Jackie's birthday the year before we got married, and he appeared on television a year later. He sort of hung around. He was originally made to show people about metric conversion, so that shows you how long ago it was.
I think you specialised in giraffes along the way too.
Oh, yes, well, as well as all of that, we, about 25 years ago, started making the Harold the Happy Healthy Giraffe, which people would probably know from life education, and we build them all, and so far Jackie and I have made 269 giraffes. There's something nice about making the same puppet over and over and over. And every year they come home at Christmas time for grease and oil, so they go out looking very nice and
but
happy.
But children in schools know them very, very well because the Life Education Centre send vans around all the schools.
I think there's 120
And what
vans.
Are the giraffes meant to teach them?
Well, it's about drug, alcohol, and sex.
And, but also healthy living, I think.
Healthy living.
I'm wondering what I could learn about all that from a giraffe. Well, what is it about taking on these personas? I mean, making these personas, but also then, in some sense, you're writing them, Jackie, but embodying them.
I think it's two things. You're distilling everything down to its essence of good and evil, action and involving an audience. Children learn very quickly, I think, from puppets. I suppose Sesame Street kind of proves that because it's another world. And we have our two theatres in Sydney, which are called puppeteria theatres. And they're very tiny theatres. So a full house
very
is like
intimate.
50 people, adults and children. So it's not like a Wiggles concert with 5,000 of your best friends. It's very small. The puppets interact with the people. And because it's very small, we can target age ranges. So, for example, in the school holidays that are coming up, we have programs for 2 to 5-year-olds and we have programs for 3 to 9-year-olds.
Well, I'm struck by some of the shows, Jackie, that you're running soon. And they're quite traditional stories. Do you then write a twist into them?
I have my own stamp on every story. Now, if I'm writing for young children and with 2 to 5-year-olds, I'm likely to get 12 months to 6, basically. That's what's going to turn up. Well, I'm doing Red Riding Hood and I have to be very careful with things like the wolf in Little Red Riding Hood or when I'm doing the three pigs, the same deal.
You can't because be too frightening.
Children can
They need
be...
a bit of fright though, don't they?
I tend to have very silly wolves. So rather than being nasty, and he wants to be nasty, he wants to eat Red Riding Hood, I always have her as manipulating him in the end. So she good always conquers evil in my shows.
Wolf wins.
The wolf doesn't win. She wins. But, you know, good conquers evil. He spends his time trying to dupe everybody and he's the one that's duped.
But also so, we have a rule that no one ever gets killed, so the wolf never gets killed. He just runs away or something like that.
So not quite as gruesome as those traditional fairy tales.
No.
We've only got about a minute left. Yeah. Literally, I want to meet some of the other characters you've brought in.
Well, this is
So we've got...
This is Ethel Red, the
you
witch.
You might want to sample of voices. Do you want to do
yes, please. I think you need to do the rest of the interview in voice.
I'm Ethel Red, the witch, the world's worst witch, and this is my broom.
You look very green. Are you feeling unwell,
I've been working
Ethel?
On that complexion for some time. Here comes Little Red Riding Hood.
Oh, hello, Little Red Riding Hood.
I'm Little Red Riding Hood, and I'm on my way to Grandma's. She's sick, you know.
Hello,
are you
sick? Oh, taking her up.
Oh, are you the big bad wolf?
No, I'm a very nice wolf. I've come to Life Matters because I have learned that life matters.
Is that funny?
I don't know. Natasha's laughing.
Poor
so it
Little
must
Red
be.
Riding Hood. Good luck with the shows. We'll put details up on the Laugh Matters website.
About the puppeteria theatres.
About the puppeteria theatres in Sydney. Do you travel?
Our son travels around doing shows in preschools, but after 35 years of travelling around the countryside, it's really nice just to put a key in the door, open the door and go and do the
Keeping
show.
Keeping it local and pulling that hand out of the puppet. Now, thank you very much, John and Jackie Lewis. Thank you so much. Of Jarrell Puppets and the Puppeteria Theatres. We'll put the details on the Life Matters website. Oh, Books and Arts Daily. Sorry, Michael, we're squeezing you a bit. You're going to sing.
Bum, 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 da-da-dum, dum, 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 da-da-dum, da-dum, dum, da-da-dum. Rigoletto. We're talking about Rigoletto.
Mm,
we're not advertising pasta sauce. We're talking about Rigoletto, which is a very nasty opera indeed.
I heard a beautiful bit of it on breakfast this morning. Looking forward to that, Michael. Thanks. Mm. And our Friday talkback this week, next on Life Matters, women's sports. Coming up, 10 a.m. news time.
On Background Briefing, a homeless woman's story that shocked a city.
Somebody had thrown acid on her at the park. These type of incidents are not common in Australia.
She was well known as a beggar.
She always wanted, you know, money urgently for something.
But was she also involved in a lucrative visa scam?
Arranged marriages for the money, and then they get married to get the visa.
The secret life and mysterious death of Monica Chetty. You can download this Background Briefing from the RN website.